Part 2. Distribution of Responsibility. Emerson, in his spare stony New England a few miles from Walden, could write, "Things are in the saddle, and ride mankind." He could say more now. Randall Jarrell, a sad heart at the supermarket. 3 a.m. outside the Aldi Distribution Center in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. I'm balled up shivering. Fists clenched beneath armpits, knees clenched to chest, in some sort of woke rigor mortis, blinking awake in the 3 a.m. darkness, listening to the first sounds of this new day, a quiet whisper of a trickle as the trucker in the bunk below me slides to the edge of her bed and begins softly pissing into a plastic garbage bag. We are parked here, in a rumbling cab not 25 feet from a truck stop and its bank of well-lit, regularly cleaned bathroom stalls. But this bag pissing, this dedication to efficiency, even at the cost of common sense and common smells, is the way of the trucker, or so I've been told. There is a moan of relief like a back massage, then a long pause. Well, fuck me, tomorrow came today. We got 15 minutes. There's a fit of coughing at this, the cough of a woman who smokes 2 packs of cigarettes a day and drinks a 6-pack of Pepsi every morning before noon, a disgusting cough to listen to, wet and moldy, a tumbling of moss and rotten sponge. "Rise and shine, sunshine," she growls. "I'm getting coffee. You want any?" She slides through the seats, cracks open the door. The yellow overheads pop on in the cabin, and the roar and heat from the 250 trucks idling around us pour in from the outside. And Lynn Riles, this coughing, sputtering, stumbling trucker, clicks leashes on her 2 beagles and clambers down the 5-foot drop from the driver's side door to walk them in the parking lot below. 14 minutes later, twin coffees steaming in the front seat, we're rolling out to an Aldi distribution center on a mission to deliver a load of groceries. I didn't seek out this most elemental point in distribution so much as sink into it, repertorially gravitating to Lynn Riles, no different from water when it settles to the lowest point after all other outlets are sealed. And make no mistake, all other outlets were sealed. In general, as has been well reported by others, industrial food is a paranoid business. Big, fat, pushy corporations all clinging to their tiny edge, well burned by bad press, convinced that their customers are skittish and insane, best treated like children to be protected for their own good from information that they can neither assess nor understand. It's a self-serving parochialism, but not completely unfounded. People are skittish and insane when it comes to their food. They not only want, they demand through buying power completely impossible, unsustainable opposites, low price and high quality, immediate availability, and customized differentiation, and then react apoplectically to the often ingenious, if Frankensteinian, solutions industrial food creates to bridge the gap. Footnote. In terms of the ingenious, if Frankensteinian, solutions, I'm thinking in particular of pink slime, i.e. the use of high-powered centrifuges to upcycle otherwise discarded beef trimmings and inject them into ground meat, a process that slurps the protein matrix right off the bone and compresses it into a rosy goo. It was a process greeted with universal outrage when revealed, not just because of that rosy goo, but because of the ammonia gassing required to smother any pathogens in it. Yet, also, clearly, even endearingly to my weird eyes, an attempt by a sociopathic industry to find a win-win, giving customers the lower-fat, higher-protein meat they wanted at an ever-lower price. End footnote. The result is our current mess of ag secrecy laws, rotten third-party certification and no-comment press releases, perfectly symbolized by those windowless sealed concrete bunkers that make up our nation's slaughterhouses. But even within that backdrop, the secrecy in retail grocery is staggering. The 1.5% gross margin and microscopic points of differentiation create conditions where trade secrets are very real. When push came to shove, it took me 2 days to line up an undercover visit to a cage-free chicken facility to fact-check ethical claims about animal treatment. It took me 2 years to find a retail food broker who would let me shadow him on his rounds. A consultant I speak with estimates that 50% of his meetings are, quote, single blind, where he doesn't even know the identity of the brand he's consulting on or the specifics of the product they are paying him to comment on because the people hiring him are too afraid he might share details with a competitor. Every single grocery executive I reached out to either demanded an off-record conversation or spoke in such vagaries as to render our conversation imbecilic. They were happy to outline a vision of the grocery store available to every second grader willing to open a Richard Scarry book, but details? Forget about it. Which is to say, when I decided I need to visit the warehouses and distribution centers that form the hubs of the food world, the type of behind-the-scenes access I was looking for was uniformly denied. Instead, I was left with either applying for a job at a warehouse, which I thought long and hard about but rejected as impractical, or smuggling myself in with a trucker, which sounded kind of fun until I did it. I met Lynn a week earlier in an empty parking lot. She's talking on a Bluetooth headpiece, stomping around the asphalt, her rig gleaming behind her. I didn't know what to expect, but not this. Standing a solid 6 feet 2 inches, large in all proportions, overweight and none, Lynn looks like she walked off some Cro-Magnon shot put team. Her hair hangs straight down like a stringy curtain over her face. She wears cowboy boots, a t-shirt, and jeans with a strategic rip up by the hip butt, a mushroom white patch of flesh peeking through and winking when she takes long strides. She brushes back that hair to take a cigarette from her mouth. Then she says, "He's here," to no one but me. Her phone call definitely over, the Bluetooth off her face, and suddenly a giant hand is struck out to greet me, attached to a very skeptical glance. We stand there and handshake for a moment. "I recommend you get yourself a Gatorade bottle." She looks me up and down. "Wide mouth for you." I don't believe I react to this. "Stop looking pale. I'm just fucking with you. Nothing in those pants looks like you're a wide mouth anything." She turns back to the truck. "I'm saying we'll be doing a lot of driving. Hope you know what you're getting into." I didn't. As soon as we get on the highway, a whole new landscape pops into view. The four-wheelers, Lynn's terminology, which I helplessly adopt, shrink, zipping around like annoying gnats. There are ubiquitous signs I've never noticed. Height restrictions, axle restrictions, prohibited bridges. Each vital points of information that cannot be ignored. The vigilance required is exhausting and lonesome. The four-wheelers below, Lynn tells me, are completely unaware of the dangers lurking above them and must be managed like children. The trucker is constantly on edge, recalculating braking distance based on the load, expecting and then reacting to major equipment failure, tensing up at the slightest precipitation in a manner that simply has no analog in the modern car. Runway ramps are meaningful lifelines, shifting into the wrong lane, merging onto any and every off-ramp, a momentary lack of caution, or just for a half second treating your truck like a regular car will lead to a death. "In a car, your blind spot might be a few feet. Mine is 53 feet, Lynn explains, slowly shifting lanes. And nobody out there, except your fellow fraternity of truck drivers, gives you any credit. Safety is a baseline we all take for granted, as we should, but it is alternately unnerving and impressive to sit in the passenger seat of an 18-wheeler and see how much effort and focus go into maintaining that baseline. The interior of the cab is snug. Directly behind Lynn sits a giant blue Rubbermaid cooler packed with ice and Pepsis. Lynn estimates she drinks about 12 cans a day. Buried in the ice, I also find a gallon-sized Ziploc bag of hard-boiled quail eggs, a present from a retired trucker friend now farming. Lynn tells me she's trying to get into them. She wants to go paleo. Next to her, at all times, cigarettes. They get lit end-to-end, marking the drive in 10-minute increments. Her steering wheel is comically big, just over a large pizza in diameter, and covered in a custom pink leather casing for grip. It's an awful pink, all flesh and innards. To her right, section to the dash, there's a pink iPhone case in a somewhat more reassuring shade. A pink trapper keeper serves as her logbook. In the back is the bunk area, pink blankets tucked in military tight with pink pillows atop them. By the pillows, a cold steel revolver wedged into a pink holster. And when she gives me spare keys to get in the passenger side door, the ring is a little pink penis with pink balls to serve as chain. From our vantage, now humming along the highway 10 feet aloft, the four-wheelers below are transparent. It's like a nature show. Humans in their habitat, completely unaware they can be observed. I see couples fighting, a man drinking a beer, countless drivers texting, their micro swerves as they tap and look up and tap away again, obvious as they are oblivious. One of the great comforts of a car is the sense of containment and privacy. It's a little pod of refuge in a life harried by other people. But whatever you think you're getting away with, the trucker can see it all. "People whip their dicks out," Lynn explains. "You'd be shocked at how many men are driving in their cars with dicks out. What the fuck are you guys doing down there?" She says this with a straw in her mouth, one hand on the wheel, one hand reaching back to the cooler to grab a fresh Pepsi, a zombie motion of habit. "I've called in so many DUIs, so cocky, malt liquor in the cup holder. Yoo-hoo, I can see you." Lynn narrates the world to herself with the intensity of someone who has known absolutely awesome amounts of alone time. It is a diatribe against loneliness, as if she must recreate the world as she sees it verbally, lest it disappear and her own existence get negated. At first, this seems like an interviewer's dream, a subject overflowing with commentary, dripping with color. The curse words fly, the anecdotes hum. I learn about her mother, who had her at 16, that bitch Clarissa, who stole her car, the daughter she had at 22, her teeth, her lack of teeth, giving up her daughter for adoption, a husband she didn't see for 22 years. But then we move from anecdote to commentary, commentary to random observation. For a while, I thought she did this for my benefit. Almost performance art, and I often wanted to let her know she didn't have to speak on my accord. But early on our third day, I realized that is all wrong. We had parked for the afternoon to nap in preparation for a 2 a.m. wake-up. Lynn had gone to let the dogs pee, and I crawled into the upper bunk, desperate for some alone time. I hear her approach across the lot with the same laughing, swearing, coughing, sighing monologue as always, talking to no one and everyone at once, listening to it. Knowing it wasn't for my benefit was both curious and exhausting. By the end of the fifth day, it is assaultive. Lynn will have 4 to 5 hour conversations with me that consist of continuous monologue, where I'm reduced to cowering yips, uh-huh, or the occasional completely flat, tonally non-ascending, really. I start to wonder whether her conversation with me is obtuse, oblivious, i.e. she simply doesn't recognize or care about the social cues I'm sending out, or actually combative, using words as a weapon. I know things have taken a dark turn when I consider getting earplugs for hanging around a woman I'm ostensibly here to interview. Bunking in the cab of an 18-wheeler is a little like sleeping inside a refrigerator, which is, of course, close to what you are doing. The reefer unit behind you blasts air at 34 degrees to keep the carcasses or broccoli cold. There's a perpetual hum from the motor, and you're living inside the rumble, on a bunk shelf, not unlike a condiment up there next to the eggs. If you're driving team and sleeping back there on your own, there's often no light until the door is cracked and the overheads come on. The vents gush AC, so you're shivering in this rumbling, humming box. Looking around in the darkness, everything feels held over from the nautical world, the 18 dials on the dash, each registering something different and essential about, say, the pressure in your landing gear or the temperature of your brake lines. Their presence is deceptive, of course. The real metrics, the ones you are judged on and paid for, are automated and digitized, beamed direct from your cab to your controller back at dispatch. But all the little dials and meters are reassuring in human scale, giving the illusion of individual control. In all, from bunk to dash, it's a refrigerator about the size of a midtown elevator, maybe 7 feet across, 7 feet to the wheel, height sloping upward with the windshield. The cold of the AC makes huddling under heaps of blankets an obvious choice. The decision to get up and move, a painful one. But as the week progresses, I realize there's something more paralyzing going on, something enervating about the truck itself, a draining dependence on machine. It is a complacency not unlike feeling yourself glued to your couch, disgusted with the TV, but also somehow unable to get up to click it off. The truck itself, by its very confinement, in the way all possessions and comforts are just an arm's length away, by its foreclosing of the outside world, creating a little pod of convenience, submarine or shuttle-like, weans you from a desire to connect or exert. It then gradually increases this stasis through a feedback loop. The more you stay in the truck, the more it acts on you. The more it acts on you, the more you stay in the truck, the inaction itself growing like a depressive mold. I see it everywhere at the truck stops we pass through. The unwillingness to get out of the cab to stroll around. That insistence of urinating in a bag rather than a bathroom. The lonely men eating behind the same wheel they sat driving at for the previous 8 hours. The feeling of isolation despite the presence of a sizable population. And after a few days, I can feel it happening to me. I start to stay seated at rest stops alongside Lynn. We both get up and move around, but don't crack that door. The landscape outside involves just enough marginal effort that I'll find myself deciding to stay put and send a few emails from my phone rather than walk around, while next to me, Lynn stares into her cell phone and narrates a game of Farmtown. The roar of the truck stop itself is a more monstrous groan of the refrigerator hum inside each individual cab. It's a sonic blanket, muffling all other sounds in the dark, a silence at 60 decibels. I walk through one night. It's earth-moving. Dinosaurs at slumber, each shivering in their lane, each with a little human inside. The smell is of urine and fuel, the asphalt hot and wet, water from air conditioners puddling between the lanes. Looking in, I see a true multi-ethnic family of truckers, all isolated in their cabs. A man preparing ramen in his underwear. An obese woman doing seated stretches, arms above head. Then there are those outside the family of truckers, the dealers alternately offering to sell me twisters and just begging for a dollar. The gaunt prostitutes rapping on windows for work. As I walk, I count the trucks, but give up around 180 cabs. I've just begun, and row after row remain ahead in the dark. When I go inside the truck stop, the smell is of dryer sheets. It's 12:30 a.m. The floor's bright and gleaming and crowded with drivers, some just waking, groggy, about to leave for a delivery. Others wandering aimless, trying to process a landscape not moving at 57 miles per hour. I realize every reader has seen these types of rest stops before, the Flying J, Love's, or Petro's, many of which overlap with the type of truck stop I'm describing. But where you and I walk in from the front exit and exit with a styrofoam cup of coffee, the trucker enters from the rear. It's an alternate side, far bigger and stranger. I walk past a tattoo parlor, a barber shop, then a laundromat. Up the stairs, I find a gym and a locker room. Every few minutes, there's a crackle over the loudspeaker. Attention, professional driver number 153, shower number 7 is now available. It breaks over the Christian rock with a sad functionality, similar to the way dancers are called up to the stage at a strip club. Off to the side, past an empty blinkering arcade, past a separate room of creepy, coin-operated kiddie rides that look profoundly unwritten, I find the driver's lounge. It's a dismal place, darkly lit, full of men sleeping, chin to sternum, hands clasped over belly, belly barely moving. The TV is on the Weather Channel, but nobody is speaking or watching it. Some sit with guts out and proud, others with guts bound by suspenders, like they're there to frame the guts' magnificence. Mesh hats on the fat white guys, do-rags on the fat black ones, cowboy boots all around. These are the loneliest parts of the grocery world. All these silent men coming and coming into these rest stops off the conveyor of the road, quietly stocking themselves like items on a shelf, in these faux leather chairs, in front of this TV that nobody's watching, hands crossed over their bodies in a hug, palm on arm, flesh reassuring flesh, even if it's their own flesh. Let's pause to locate Lynn within the trucking ecosystem. First of all, understand that everything, everything in your life comes to you on a truck. This is a favorite self-affirming aphorism truckers love to repeat. I hear it constantly, but it has the benefit of being true. From the big appliances of our lives to the smallest bite of food, every single staple, butter knife, copper wire, or ceramic mug comes via truck. This is true whether you order online next-day delivery for your milk or opt to live off-grid and self-sufficient. If you build it yourself, the parts you use for building arrived on a truck. If you grow it, the seeds, organic fertilizer, and baling wire for your compost bin arrive that way too. Trucking as an industry is gargantuan. 10.7 billion tons of freight per year get moved around this great land on trucks, which breaks down to 54 million tons a day, or 350 pounds per man, woman, and child per day. It is the most common form of employment in the majority of American states, with more than 12.6 million commercial drivers circulating our highways. And at the same time, it is one of the most dangerous jobs, right up there with deep-sea fishermen and timber cutters, boasting the highest total number of deaths per year of any job. It is also an industry uniquely connected to life. In a literal sense, trucking is the circulatory system through which GDP flows, and truckers are particularly keen to its kinks and expansions, their routes reflecting the strength of Christmas giving or sudden recessionary anxiety. Some items see only a few trucks in their lives. Most see dozens. Some hundreds. Trucks backing into manufacturing centers, unloading items themselves manufactured, themselves brought in on different trucks from different manufacturing centers, down, down, down to eventually raw material extraction, a supposed zero point, but upon closer inspection, itself a mass of lugging and unloading, choked with trucks, a process of input as much as extraction, for feeding the workers, for delivering the pesticides, for maintaining the machinery, so that you can almost fractally descend into any part of the chain until it feels like the only constant beyond carbon when it comes to our possessions is truck, a fabric and glue. And within every truck, a trucker, snuffing down Pepsis, coughing phlegm, butt bouncing high on the seat, invisibly but unrelentingly attached to consumption itself. Within that ecosystem, Lynn is just a tiny node. Driver, Lynn. Long haul or OTR, over the road, the unhelpful acronym used by the trucking industry to define her work as someone who runs an inconsistent, termed non-dedicated, route, picking up commercial loads in one place, dropping them off in another, going wherever she's told. Load planner, Kirk. Overseer of Lynn's load board. The load board is a stock exchange of need and availability. Kirk surveys a region, connects dots of demand, and programs a route the driver will take. To do this, he sits in front of a Google Maps-like display with every driver in the area pinned there. He can see driver stats, miles per week, on-time percent, load refusal, complaints about attitude. And like a teenager at the risk board, he can push the pieces around with surprising caprice, rewarding favorites, penalizing anyone who makes his life more difficult. Dispatcher, Jim. He just had a heart attack. Jim is a messenger between the driver and the load planner. He's tasked with managing the human being. He checks in and cajoles, bullshits, and answers questions. Lynn loves him. She notes, however, that Jim gets paid when she's sitting on the dock, waiting, trapped and unpaid and unable to leave. But then, so does basically everyone else in the system, so it's hard to hold it against Jim too long. Dog. Lynn has two, Katie and Bella, both beautiful beagles. They are there for sanity and to provide connection. Truckers cling to dogs with an intensity that rivals the mother-child bond. Trucking without them would be a cruelty that might not be tolerated by the driver, as opposed to a cruelty that is. Receiver. I'm using this loosely to cover everyone from the smartass at the guard station to the workers zipping around on motorized pallet jacks like they're in the Jetsons. The receiver is where the load gets delivered, generally a giant warehouse or distribution center, but often, especially with bigger grocers, the back of the store directly. Lumper. This is the person who physically unloads the truck. Lumping is brutal work. Injuries are common, and so employing someone who is neither an employee of the shipper, the trucking company, nor the receiver allows the larger companies to avoid liability. Lynn is invited to lump her own, often for as much as $200 a load, but she refers to that as insanity, by which she means the route to a quick injury that would lay her up for weeks. Instead, she pays the lumper with money supplemented in her paycheck for that purpose. Producer. These are the great food manufacturers of America. Industrial vats full of boiling marinara, canisters of vanilla extract taller than a 10-year-old boy, the blur of assembly lines and robotics that package, box, and stack our food so it's ready to be picked up by driver, Lynn. From the highway, the Aldi distribution center is a white box of light in the 4 a.m. darkness. As we drift up the exit ramp toward it, we slowly queue behind other trucks. Then we stop completely, idling in a long line waiting at the guard station. Despite the early hour, the activity isn't surprising. The drive from our overnight spot was among a caravan of truckers. Cab to trailer, all plodding forth, this mechanical herd taking over the road while the world it serves sleeps. Lynn flips her pink logbook open as we sit, making handwritten notes against the steering wheel, carrying on a conversation with a trucker two states away trapped in the middle of a similar delivery. They cackle over Bluetooth about the best place to sleep in Gary, Indiana, while we inch forward. Finally, we arrive, and Lynn rolls down her window to announce her load. The man clicks around on his console station, swivels to the side, speaks into a headset microphone, then swivels back to us. You're early. Yes, sir. About 15 minutes, I'd reckon, Lynn says, shifting into a register of respect and concern I haven't yet seen. There's a silence on the other side. Some non-obvious power dynamic is going down. Okay, then. A long pause hangs here. Head in. We rumble through the barbed wire fencing into a gargantuan parking lot capable of swallowing our 18-wheeler, rendering it matchbox-sized all of a sudden. The distribution center, so banal from the highway, is mammoth now, wide enough to accommodate at least 80 trailers on its four sides. We roll around the building slowly, Lynn looking for her assigned gate. Each of the 80 spots is filled, every truck plugged in to its own loading dock. The trailer sticking out perpendicular like USB drives snug into some central processor. Their lanes are tight, just enough space to walk single file between the trailers. As we roll past, we see drivers at the wheel, each filling out paperwork, scrolling on their cell phones, or staring lonely into the night as their truck's innards are pulled out behind them. Once Lynn backs into her lane and inserts her trailer into the assigned gate, for all practical purposes, her work is done. She has delivered her product safe and on time. But she isn't free to leave. Instead, Lynn enters one of the many gray portions of her labor market. She's at the mercy of her receiver's schedule. It can take 30 minutes or 5 hours. The last several loads we delivered went seamlessly. Lynn pulled up at her appointment time, and within an hour, the truck was emptied or filled, respectively. Lynn set down her cell phone, ambled out of her cab to swap paperwork, and we rolled on our way. This morning, we wait. First, there's someone in her lane, so we pull to the edge of the parking lot until they leave. This takes about an hour. The sky begins bluing with impending dawn. Then, after backing in, nobody's ready to unload her. This adds another 45 minutes. Finally, when the lumpers are ready, we have about an hour and 15 of waiting for her paperwork to clear. That's a third of a day of unpaid, unrecognized labor at the ungodly hour of 4 a.m. And the entire time is spent in the truck. Anything that happens outside of this truck, I'm not insured, Lynn explains to me. If I get hurt on the dock, I'm screwed. So yeah, I feel better in here. I just play Farm Town. I nod. And let's be honest, what's going on out there that I'm missing? You know, I've been playing Farm Town for 6 years. I used to have DVDs and videos, but then I found Farm Town. I thank God for Farm Town. Another $100 work week. While we wait, we try to calculate what she might make for the load. We started at Alamance Food outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, as spare a cement loading dock as exists in America. Two Mexican lumpers scooted pallets of something labeled dairy into our depths. From there, Lynn scrawled her signature on a clipboard. The lumpers pulled down the back door, slapped us goodbye on the proverbial rump, and Lynn drove off. We had 1,050 miles to go and three stops to make at different distribution centers. For this, Lynn gets $1,231 gross, or $1.16 per mile, which Lynn tells me is pretty decent for a brokered load. On top of this, the shipper, Alamance, adds a $368.50 fuel surcharge, a dollop extra to pay for the fuel, her single greatest cost by a wide margin. It all sounds fairly good for 2 to 3 days of work, but that is the lure. Now comes the hook. First, a blizzard of deductions. 28% of the gross and 10% of the fuel is snatched off the top by Cargill for the privilege of driving in their fleet. Then there's a $300 weekly payment for leasing the truck she drives. There's the $300 she has to pay for the week prior, when work was slow, but her truck payment was still due. Then there are the lumper fees, heavy usage taxes, costs for various federally mandated fuel additives, and a mandatory cleaning service after every load, where a dude with a jetpack-like device sprays down the inside of her trailer, no matter how clean or dirty it is. So without any other expenses, we're below $500 for the entire trip. From there, reality continues to intercede. The fuel surcharge almost never covers her actual expense. The truck is supposed to be able to make 6 miles per gallon when fully loaded, but we never break 4.5 miles per gallon the entire time I'm riding. This 4.5 miles per gallon is also exclusively driving time. It doesn't count the quarter tank Lynn estimates she loses when we idle overnight. That quarter tank, by the way, is not the quarter tank of your Honda sedan. Lynn's Peterbilt has two tanks on each side, both massive, 120 gallons on the driver's side, 150 gallons on the passenger side. Not to mention a 50-gallon refrigerator tank that keeps our veggies crisp and that lasts only 24 hours when Lynn is hauling a load. Then there are the fixed costs that aren't taken out of this particular load but need to be accounted for somehow. Lynn pays taxes per mile, per state, and needs an accountant to handle the complexity of that. Or at least the trucking company who issues her check demands that she use one. They also demand that she retain their lawyer to handle billing disputes. Then there's insurance, also demanded by the carrier without the opportunity to shop around. Then maintenance on her truck, which, when you drive 12,000 miles a month, is a whole different ball of wax than regular car maintenance. Then an escrow account called her security, to which, again, she's contractually obligated to contribute, which is maintained by the trucking company, held entirely at their discretion, and that serves as a backstop should she ever throw up her arms and decide she wants to walk away from her lease-to-own agreement. Finally, there are a host of tiny fees for administrative work, for mapping devices, mobile communication terminals, some of which she can't completely explain even as they bleed her paycheck. Finally, there are the inherent risks, which, as an owner-operator, Lynn has assumed entirely on behalf of her trucking company. The week before I joined her, while she dozed at a truck stop, the driver next to her crunched into her. Lynn awoke to the jolt and scrambled out of her bunk, only to watch as the driver fled the lot. She guesses he was a rookie and his whole career was on the line. One early crash and you're out. But regardless of his identity, she was stuck with an insurance claim. I bring this up because the ever-diminishing sum we calculated Lynn would make for the load consisted of her earnings before beginning the trip. The open road is unpredictable in almost every way except one. The longer you're on it, the more certain something costly will happen. It takes a shift in mindset, one the rookie driver almost never makes, But this is not about bad luck. A hit and run might be rare, but it's just one risk among thousands. Trailer brakes failing, tires blowing, reefer line freezing, that collectively become inevitable. In this case, the damage was exclusively to her fairing, the plastic paneling around the undercarriage. The best possible outcome. It was both superficial and inexpensive. And yet, despite her insurance coverage, the $1,000 deductible on her policy left her liable for the entire amount. If I need a repair done and I actually have the money, I just pay for it, she says. But that's never the case. Instead, I got to get approval, then I got to get a loan, then they charge extra fees for the loan, and then I have to use their garage to get it fixed. Worst of all, every time there's a repair, Lynn sits. No loads, no money coming in. And suddenly, a tiny incident takes her from a marginal place to ruin. To drill into one small but telling detail of these deductions, Lynn currently rides for Cargill because she lacks what's known as an authority. Footnote. I also can't stress how over-the-top enthralled with Cargill Lynn is. She repeatedly tells me they are the best employer she has ever had, that they treat her with a respect she hasn't found with any other trucking company, that they are reliable, friendly, and give her quality loads. This seems important to note as her outsized, almost manic gratitude for basic decency is probably one of the best second-order indications about what her life was like with prior carriers. End footnote. If she had an authority, she could deal with a broker on her own. She could negotiate rates that are higher, and she wouldn't have to sacrifice almost a third of her pay off the top. But Lynn can't get one. It isn't the cost of the authority, which at the current registration fee of $1,200 is not outrageous, although probably unattainable for someone who chooses to skip meals to save money. It is the structural requirements behind the authority. As she tells it, even if she were given the $1,200 for an authority today, she'd be no closer to getting one. If I was on my own, I'd pull a load tomorrow and not get paid for 6 months, she tells me. Like a lot of contract labor, pay comes slowly and irregularly. And operating as a true independent would require a minimum of 6 months of fuel out of pocket, 6 months of grocery bills, and 6 months of fees to her accountant and attorney. So even though Cargill, like all carriers, takes a healthy percent for allowing her to use their authority, she stays put. I'd need an office too, she says, after some thought, which could be in your house, but I don't really have a house. I have an RV right now. She pauses. But that's in storage. There is a long pause here. What I'm saying is I'd need an address. Lynn estimates she grossed $200,000 last year. That's a rough calculation based on miles driven, but that she took home less than $17,000. This for a 14-year veteran trucker who knows her industry inside and out, who participates on trucking blogs, mentors younger truckers about the snares and scams, who lives in her truck and stays out on the road 3 weeks at a time, who works more than 70 hours the week I'm with her, much of it spent in a state of constant vigilance, where she sleeps in 4 to 5 hour bursts and wakes up for 3:30 a.m. appointments that are make or break for her career, but ignored by the distribution center on the other side, who didn't see her mother for 2 years because she didn't have the time off and couldn't get loads that lined up with her mother's location. The $17,000 also, based on my experience with her, is a number likely inflated by pride. The week I'm with her, Lynn receives a weekly paycheck for just $100, which is what she received the week before, and the week before that. It's in my contract, she tells me. No matter how many expenses I have, I always have the right to a check for $100. So that's what I usually get. I've gotten pretty good at knowing how to stretch it. And in reality, the week I'm with her, that $100 represents nothing. When we go over her time together, I estimate she nets something closer to negative $150 after factoring in extravagances like cell phone bills and an unanticipated repair. So it is no surprise that when sleeping in the bunk one afternoon, I overhear her ask for a cash advance from her future $100 paychecks so she can afford to eat dinner that night. The next morning, Lynn turns to me and says, I think I can get back in the black. Maybe another 3-4 weeks of this? And it is completely unclear what she means. She is losing money. Another 3 or 4 weeks like this, and she'll be even deeper in debt, further beholden to Cargill. Or I could run into a ladder on the interstate that tears my brake lines, she says, to complete both our thoughts. To recap, Lynn is homeless, sleeping exclusively in the cab of a truck she does not yet own and almost certainly will eventually lose when she can no longer make payments on it. Her credit is shot. She has outstanding vet bills for her two dogs, the closest and most beloved members of her family. Her personal health is so wrecked, it's hard to even discuss. Suffice to say, she cannot eat most food because she lost every one of her teeth and her new dentures are not properly fitted, so it pains her to chew. Her obsession with Pepsi for calories shifts in my brain into absolute sadness when I learn this. She's also very good at her job, hyper-vigilant on the road, and extremely hardworking. A team player who never in my presence complains about a task given to her or her lot in life. These things are not unrelated. Debt and hope. There are some jobs where it's almost impossible to succeed because they are very difficult. Then there are jobs where you're designed to fail. Lease-to-own programs and OTR trucking seem like both to me. During my time with the reefer trucks, talking to the men and women who constitute the circulatory system of our economic lives, who touch each and every can of beans we touch twice, I come to see the trucking industry as structurally vampiric. I don't say this to be dramatic. It's an industry that creeps along the margins of society and seduces the vulnerable, feeding itself on their aspirations, coaxing them to lend a little bit of their lives and credit in exchange for a promise that is almost never delivered, a stable job and control over their own destiny. Debt is the financial instrument that best expresses hope. Industrial trucking is brilliant at this precise exchange. I hear repeatedly about trucking recruiters who cruise for drivers from homeless shelters, soup kitchens, recovery wards, prison work release programs. Many more come from minimum wage retail, from construction, from several tours of duty overseas. These men and women are promised guaranteed jobs, no experience, no problem, get paid while training, fantastic money. Salary quotes range from the reasonable and enticing, earn up to $60,000, to the patently absurd, $100,000 per year and freedom. They're offered free one-way bus tickets directly to training centers if they quit their old life. They're housed in company motels with all costs paid for up front by the company and assured they can pay back everything from future earnings. Meals are provided. Footnote. The stories from these training center motels will loosen the jaw a solid 30 degrees. Junkies wandering the hallways looking for a fix and finding it from another recruit. Fistfights, armed robbery, self-harm from obvious mental illness, and if you are one of the 5% of recruits who are a woman, sexual harassment from a fellow recruit, senior driver, trainer, or all three. End footnote. And with just a quick signature on the third or fourth day, suddenly they are students who've taken on real live student debt to prove it, training to earn a commercial driver's license. Once in the classroom, they're pounded with further praise for seizing this chance to control their own destiny. The job they were initially offered vaporizes, and an even better offer appears. Now they can become owner-operators, and by signing just a few more papers, they will get their own truck without having to pay a cent. Once they accept, they will then be run ragged, desperately trying to make good on their end of the bargain, spending their next 6 months deciphering pay stubs, trying to understand why running tens of thousands of miles at 30 to 90 cents a mile never gets them more than $100 a week. Not realizing until far too late how difficult it is. At which point, drained of the motivation that initially made them useful to the carrier, they are bounced out of the industry, financially crippled, embittered, and often too proud to admit it. For this opportunity, all that is required is they have a clear driving record for the last 3 years. Smaller hurdles, like a minor drug or alcohol problem, can be smoothed over. They told me to ease up on the honesty speech. Quit doing it. Tom Hansen, trainer at one of the larger companies, told Dan Rather when describing his attempts to weed out substance abusers. And if, at any point in the process, you wake up in your motel bed, shivering because it lacks insulation, squinting at your third roommate who's been leaving a cheap 9mm out on his duffel, and decided this whole experience is not precisely what you thought it was going to be, you're on the hook for the cost of the entire training, somewhere between $3,000 and $8,000, depending on the carrier. And you still have to buy that one-way bus ticket back to whatever life you quit to come out here. Trucking used to be a middle-class job. This was during the long golden stretch from 1935 to 1980, when transportation was a tightly regulated, almost cartel-like industry. Federal law, as applied through the Interstate Commerce Commission, restricted the number of carriers, allowed overt price collusion between those that remained, and exempted the entire industry from antitrust laws. This was not a good thing, nor a sign of a healthy industry, but it allowed a small cohort of carriers to grow extremely powerful and correspondingly provided the perfect conditions for collective bargaining. Jimmy Hoffa was a teamster first and foremost, and the strong, if corrupt, union he led was able to wrest a middle-class salary with benefits from that cohort. By the 1970s, trucking became the favorite scruffy but lovable blue-collar profession, hence the slew of corny hit movies from Smokey and the Bandit, Convoy, and Breaker Breaker that would flop instantly today if released in any format except for horror. This golden era was anti-competitive, inefficient, and opposed across the political spectrum from Ralph Nader to Ronald Reagan, but it provided a stable, respectable income for the individual trucker. Then literally overnight, with the scrawl of President Carter's pen, everything shifted. Trucking underwent a radical course correction, deregulating in extremis if you were a driver. Carriers multiplied, authorities fell from the regulatory sky, non-unionized workers flooded the market, and the price of transport dropped by 20% in just the first few years. From the golden 70s, the trucker suddenly found himself in the red and green 80s. The colors of the now essential methamphetamines drivers gobbled by the handful were given by the handful by their dispatch to carry out the marathon runs they were now asked to complete so the carrier could survive. The success of that initial phase of deregulation under the 1980 Motor Carrier Act led to a frenzy of further deregulation under the Reagan administration. Soon, the sheer volume of carriers resulted in precisely the condition the deregulators intended. Trucking became a commodity, and control over prices swung to shippers who could float a bid confident they would always find someone willing to run their freight cheaper or quicker or both. Footnote. Or to concretize, quote, long-haul truckers are producing twice the amount of measurable output compared to the late 1970s for wages that are 40% lower, author Steve Vaselli notes in his excellent 2016 ethnography, The Big Rig, Trucking and the Decline of the American Dream. End footnote. This is our current system, a machine being asked to run at ever faster rates in the name of competition, with leaner oversight, less routine maintenance, less long-term investment, with everyone involved knowing this means the belts will start to smoke and the smaller, cheaper parts get replaced as they fail. It is the payoff of deregulation and perceived as pretty much a good thing, since it certainly benefits the consumer. Margins are tight, and everyone from the broker to receiver to carrier CEO is sweating, jockeying for position. This is what is meant by, quote, running a lean operation, cutting costs to the bone, and shaving inefficiencies. Terms I hear repeated like sacred incantations by carriers explaining how they are scrambling to compete. There are real savings. Freight is cheaper. Groceries are cheaper. It turns out, however, that in trucking, along with a tire tread, brake pad, and transmission, the trucker himself is another one of those parts structurally designed to be worn to failure. I think everyone involved agrees that this isn't quite ideal, that in a perfect world, the problem of the human driver would be tidied up, eliminated by drone, automation, or some insentient mute machine. But in the meantime, the long meantime, the customer and lowest price prevail. The belt smokes, and the ingenious ways to render a man or woman disposable continue. To put this in perspective, over the last 10 years, industry turnover in trucking has ranged from 95 to 112%, which is, upon reflection, a range of percentages that barely makes sense. The turnover at a top law firm is 17%, and that has been deemed a crisis for the profession. The turnover at Starbucks is around 65%. 100% turnover in the trucking industry means that every single member of a fleet either retired or quit or was fired and was successfully replaced that year. 112% turnover for a given fleet means that the cycle repeated more than once. This might make sense if trucking were a declining industry, unable to pay its employees, but it has been growing aggressively over those same years. So what's going on? What appears to be happening is the industry has figured out not only how to make humans replaceable, but also how to make money off their replacement. The labor shortage is profitable. Recruiting rapaciously and dishonestly, convincing recruits to take out lines of credit for the opportunity, and then paying those new recruits the lowest possible wages for the labor, they call these training rates, all work synergistically. I am told by various industry observers that the trucking industry earns its highest profits on student drivers. They then use the accrued debt as a tool to force the driver to work at these rates for longer than they would otherwise. When I describe trucking as structurally vampiric, turnover is the force that creates the suction. Churn and burn. The latest and greatest scheme in this department is team driving. When a driver emerges from even the best CDL school, much less the recruitment mills previously discussed, they're simply not equipped to drive an 80,000-pound rig. Trucking may be blue-collar, but it's not unskilled. So the driver is paired with a trainer. The first month of this partnership is called running solo. The new driver must be observed full-time. When the driver drives, the trainer sits in the passenger seat and trains. By the second month, with the new driver getting his trucking legs beneath him, the team shifts to solo and a half. Now half the time the new recruit is driving, the trainer is in the back resting up to drive himself. Finally, after the eighth week, they shift to team driving. One man drives, the other sleeps. Then they swap again, and again, and again. Running team doubles the amount of road a truck can legally cover, and is a godsend for the carrier and the shipper. Footnote. The federally mandated work rules around trucking are both aggressively dry and yet vital to truly understanding how all this works in practice. If you drive, there are strict rules designed to limit the number of consecutive hours you can spend working in your truck. But because truckers work, live, and are forced during odd loading times to spend ungodly hours in their truck, these regulations have significant unintended impacts on how free you are to structure your own time. For those interested in the details, here's my best take at distilling these regulations into bite-sized comprehensibility. Basically, every day, once you move your truck, a clock starts ticking, and you have 14 hours to park it again. No more than 11 of those 14 hours can be spent driving. And you can do that day after day until you hit 70 hours of truck time within a given 8-day period, at which point you need to take a 34-hour restart. If that makes sense to you on the first read, God bless. I'm sure you aced the LSAT. The entire thing is subject to endless debates and strident all cap posts on trucking blogs, and seems to fail most significantly when a driver is stuck at one of those loading docks, as Lynn got stuck at Aldi, where the stolen time hurts triple. You are not being paid, can't pick up new work, and yet chewing away at your availability for the rest of that day/week, forcing you to rush future loads that you might otherwise have been able to rest on. It is also, for this particular footnote, what makes driving team such a godsend to shippers and carriers, solving all those problems at once. End footnote. Moving freight from California to D.C. takes 7 to 10 days on the rails. A truck driving team can shrink that to 2.5 days while offering door-to-door precision. It is also a grueling life. Team drivers live inside that 7x7 box. They don't really come out much. The box is always on the move somewhere. This actually can work tolerably for teams of brothers, sisters, and married couples, all of whom I met on the road, all of whom had mixed emotion about the dizzying life of team, but who thought they could tough it out a few more years because the money was better. But if you're a new recruit, you are partnered with a stranger, often a stranger who's undergoing the same stressful, debt-filled realization about the life they just stepped into that you're going through too. Your possessions are on top of each other. Your needs are on top of each other. Your sexual desires and rage and annoying quirks are on top of each other. It is hard, but it's efficient. And the efficiency of team driving, coupled with the extremely low training rates carriers pay new recruits, have combined to heavily incentivize turnover. There's so much money in students, Desiree Wood, a trucker and trucking advocate, tells me. They work so cheap. 12 to 13 cents a mile. It pays for the entire system. And a lot of these trainers have been driving less than 6 months themselves. It's that extreme turnover. What other industry is it common to go from student to trainer in 6 months? Half the time, there's a blowout, a fistfight, a brawl in the cab in the middle of the second month. And they leave that freight in the middle of nowhere, Desiree continues. That team is shucked. But there's always some other team just starting out that's willing to come and get the load and drive it to its destination. And the process continues. Large trucking companies have 100 new recruits coming in every week. They have that 112% turnover. And so we have cheap freight. These companies don't have enough independent contractors willing to do that type of work, especially not if they have a contract with a company the size of Amazon, Desiree explains. What they do have are students driving team. CRST, which runs one of the larger training programs, brings in approximately 10,000 new drivers each year alone. Each of the major trucking companies, CR England, Swift, Covenant, Prime, J.B. Hunt, offers a similar program of their own. When I talk to a recruiter at Covenant about the possibility of a job, she tells me, think long and hard. They own you for 10 months. When I ask her about one of her competitors, one recommended to me by Desiree as one of the best of the dirty bunch, the recruiter gasps, oh, I'd avoid them like a disease. Then she gets riled up. They'll dirty pool you. They'll take money right out of your check. And the trainers, I'm sure there's some good ones, but oh, there's a lot of slime. Of course, all of those are things I've been told about her company. But she's rolling now. You got to be careful with any training program. My first trainer was a jerk-off. He threw me off in a dirt lot. He called me a lying SOB. Look, sweetheart, basically you are brand new and paired with whoever they can wrangle. Do you want to take that chance? I'd check out a program from a community college. There are better options. This from the recruiter. They own you. The structures that allow carriers to pressure drivers into team are essentially the same as the structures that keep drivers trapped across the system. This is not far from sharecropping, Desiree says. It's debt bondage. It's sharecropping where instead of the field, they're tenants on wheels. And any decision point, from the signing of a lease purchase agreement to agreeing to drive team to installing a new, quote, voluntary monitoring device, provides the carrier with another opportunity to mold wayward drivers back into, quote, team players. Students, fresh with debt, ignorant about the industry norms and legal rights, are the easiest to manipulate. If you resist signing an owner-operator lease agreement or decide you would rather train solo when there's a burning need for team drivers, they will simply stall. A recent class action suit certified against trucking giant CR England in 2017 alleges that when new recruits demanded the jobs they were recruited for, as opposed to the owner-operator opportunities they were presented with, they were systematically told trucks aren't available and they would have to wait indefinitely for them. However, if they agreed to lease a truck or drive team, they could get out on the road immediately. This, while the driver was accruing more debt by staying on company property, accruing interest on that debt, and unable to work to pay it all back. Recruits who waited this threat out were eventually given a truck, but then the stalling continued. Actual loads didn't materialize, or they came slow and erratic, or with too few miles to make a living. This is called starving you out. And because the student is contractually bound to that carrier, thanks to the contract they signed at training, and since they owe that carrier money, again, thanks to that training, the student is completely at the mercy of the carrier and almost always plays ball and becomes a team player. They cut your miles, a trucker tells me at a truck stop, you get the message. Or as Lynn tells me about her own lease purchase agreement, I know there's a light at the end of this tunnel, because I am locked into this contract and I can't afford to believe anything else. Beyond financial strangulation, the industry also has the DAC report. DAC, D-A-C, is the catchy abbreviation for the non-grammatical, nonsensical Drive a Check report, a document that serves as sort of a credit report for drivers, listing their driver history, record of accidents, traffic violations, alongside an employment history, reasons for leaving a job, reports of damage to equipment. Like a bad credit report, a bad DAC report has major consequences, typically preventing a driver from being hired by a new company. Unlike a bad credit report, the DAC report relies on information provided by your current employer, and in practice, that means it's wielded like a threat. Drivers who report on-the-job injuries might find a no-fault accident suddenly shifted into 50% fault on their DAC. A driver who pulls to the side of the road, reporting a problem on the brake lines, might be told to complete the run. If he fails, an abandonment of equipment might appear on his DAC. A driver who refuses an overweight load, perhaps a pallet or two higher than the 80,000 per pound federal limit that makes him liable at a weigh station, might be reported for not making their appointment with a shipper. It's hard to explain just how vulnerable you are as a trucker. It reorients my understanding of the bravado in the profession. You are beholden to the carrier. They control your wages. They own your home and source of livelihood. In fact, if not an owner-operated name, they determine when you get to see your family and when you get the opportunity to work. You're beholden to the economy as a whole in a way that is far more intimate than for most of us. You are locked in a culture that venerates self-reliance and individual persistence and is hostile to displays of weakness or need. A profession where being tossed off a truck is a common and non-controversial practice, where death and life-threatening accidents are never far from the mind. You are also inherently isolated, lonely, physically vulnerable by the very nature of the job. The only thing more frightening than being alone on the side of a highway hundreds of miles away from help or cell phone reception is being isolated on the side of that same highway with someone you were driving team with, who is mentally unstable, who may or may not be about to hurt you. With my height and demeanor, I intimidate most men. But at night, you won't catch me dead walking around a truck stop, Lynn tells me. I want to walk my dogs, but it just isn't right at night. I would never wear shorts, Lynn tells me. The idea of wearing shorts around a truck stop if you're a woman? She just pauses and trails off. Walking through trucks, she tells me, that's probably the most dangerous thing you could do as a woman. I will never, ever walk through two trucks. Don't care how much time it might save me. If there's a group of guys standing around, Lynn tells me, I walk the dogs the other way. Lynn also tells me that at a truck stop, she never makes eye contact with a man, that she doesn't like taking showers at truck stops after a certain hour, that just talking to a man over a meal might get her labeled as a truck stop whore. Sometimes I just dress up like a guy at night if I have to go out, she says, cracking up with laughter at the notion. Tuck my hair under a ball cap, wear a big leather jacket to hide my tits. Oh, that's common. My friend Allison does the exact same thing. We were just laughing about it. Women make up about 5% of truckers. Every vulnerability that male truckers suffer is amplified. During my time with Lynn, I talk with the women we bump into at distribution centers. Elaine, a trucker I meet at the Aldi warehouse, tells me the one piece of advice she would give to a younger woman considering a job in trucking, stay out. Senria, young and heavily tattooed from Chicago, tells me most nights she refuses to get out of her cab at truck stops, especially if she sees big groups of men. Another woman I met at a Dairy Fresh distribution center tells me about getting out of her cab for dinner and being noticed by a man who proceeds to jump on her running board and knock on her window several times that night. Every woman I spoke with had a story of an abusive trainer, either one who assaulted them, harassed them, threatened to rape them, or did one of those things to a friend. The single exception is a woman who was trained by her husband and drove team with him exclusively. Lynn tells me, if a female trucker told me she had two trainers and said she wasn't sexually harassed, I'd be shocked. Indeed, Lynn's first trainer would sit behind her while she drove and watch porn on his computer with the volume turned up. This continued for weeks. She complained, but he denied it. It was his word against hers, and she was stuck with him. Later, he grabbed her chest hard enough to leave a bruise, which she reported to the police. Finally, she was given a new trainer. And the company was like, maybe you misconstrued it, she says. And it's like, his hand was on my chest. What the fuck did I misconstrue? While we're driving down a tiny two-lane highway in West Virginia, Lynn starts to tell me about Amy. It's the first time I ask her about being a woman in trucking. We're cruising through a narrow valley, bright green forest on both sides, the occasional collapsed farmhouse. She met Amy at orientation for her CDL. Amy was the only other woman at the training, so they bunked together. My first opinion of her was, damn, she's short, Lynn says as the valley opens wide around us. She was 5 foot nothing. A lot of other women see me as competition, but I think because of our size difference, we could talk. To be honest, we weren't close at all. I do remember she was neat and tidy. This tiny little thing. One night, about 9 months after their training, Lynn got a phone call from a number she didn't recognize. Lynn answered, and it was Amy, and she was crying. They raped her underneath the trailer, Lynn tells me, staring straight ahead at the road. There's 4 feet of clearance there. Nobody heard her scream. She crawled back to her truck, and I was the first person she called. I was 200 miles away. We talked all night long. Then, Lynn explained to her dispatcher that she had an emergency to attend, did not wait for his response, unhitched her trailer, and drove to Amy. I took her to the hospital. While they did the rape kit, she kept telling me she was screaming at the top of her lungs and nobody came to help. I didn't know what to say. I just cried with her. She didn't have anyone else. I only knew her from training. But I didn't really know her at all. Then, oh damn. And for the first time in 1,000 miles, Lynn goes completely silent, and we continue driving through the West Virginia Valley. Here again, in her fear, her experience, and her friendships, Lynn appears representative of the entire industry. I simply do not have the hard statistics to make an empirical case about the trucking industry's treatment of women. But I do know that anytime official resources scratch the surface, the stories come flooding out. A massive 270-person civil discrimination case brought in 2012 against trucking giant CRST by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was filled with agonizing depictions of harassment, abuse, assault, and rape. Woman after woman came forward to detail her treatment. The case ultimately hinged not on the veracity of the allegations, but on whether the EEOC had properly honored a statutory obligation before filing the lawsuit. Both in district court and on appeal, the court found they had not. The actual substance of the women's claims, from assault to rape to merely spending days in a cab with a man obsessively masturbating behind them while they were teaching them how to drive, were never even considered. Every woman I've ever talked to in trucking has this type of story, Desiree Wood tells me. The problem is the culture. When incidents get reported, they cost money. So the attitude is, we'll make the person who reported it go away. We'll make it seem like they are crazy or a problem. And there are enough crazy people in trucking that this works. The carrier can do that because they know most drivers aren't smart enough or connected enough to sue them or do anything about it. The attitude is, they'll slink back right where we got them. The problem is this just empowers the predators, she continues. There's no accountability. Instead, they get recirculated around the industry. And the shipper and receiver? They don't have a clue about the drama out there. They don't want to look. They just love the results. The results. While Lynn is waiting in her truck, that dawn sky blueing around us, I head inside. The receiving area at the Aldi Distribution Center is just about what you'd imagine. An endless warehouse space, spare and cold and buzzing with forklifts. We're unloading into refrigerated, so it's maybe 35 degrees. All around, sweating men with big white Mickey Mouse-style gloves dart in and out of the trailers, pulling pallets. Everyone, everywhere is on the move and on top of each other, except the truckers who stand against a far wall waiting for paperwork, bleary-eyed and bored. For the first time all trip, I see the product we have been carrying. Out it comes on pallets, piled chest high, canisters of whipped cream, row after row red plastic nose cones straight up like little missiles. The receivers swarm. The whipped cream gets barely a glance, classic, continuous product off an assembly line. But this being the refrigerated area, most other arrivals are produce. These get scrutinized, receivers patting down the sides of boxes for indentations, rifling through flats to pluck out individual strawberries. This 45-second inspection is perhaps the most important stage of quality control along the entire chain. Up until this point, there has been no sale. Now the retailer needs to fish or cut bait. Many loads never make it any further. To my right sit the rejects, moldering boxes of lettuce, leaking jugs of juice, a leaning tower of eggs 18 by 36 inches across, stove in from some collision, the yolks dripping down. Other loads are placed in holding. A glass-paneled lab sits in the corner where this potential food can be sliced open, probed with calibers for firmness, or blended into a slurry to test for sugar content. If it passes, it's popped on a forklift and whizzed deeper in the warehouse along with our whipped cream. The probes and lab evals hit at something more. The big lie here is that the warehouse is just a location for passive storage, where items are slotted in, sit around, and then get retrieved as needed. The truth for perishable grocery is closer to a NICU ward at the hospital. Blazing technology, furiously working to sustain premature life. The fruit and veg of our lives are alive and need to stay that way until we bite into them. Unlike the NICU, however, the distribution center has no interest in survivability per se. Instead, all this technology serves to control. The teenage ambition to stop, start time, pause, then unfreeze life at the perfect moment is steadily being achieved for many forms of produce. At the various distribution centers I visit, I walk into a sauna-sized room full of butter-yellow bananas, ceiling to floor, jammed with a network of probes and wires. A few doors down, I'll find wall-to-wall racks of rock-hard avocados or red, unripe tomatoes, tomatoes so firm they fall to the floor and bounce with the thud of a baseball, all of which can be kept in suspension or fast-forwarded to a ripe, saleable version, depending on need. That fresh apple you bite into has typically been sitting in dormancy for close to a year. Red cherries, that epitome of summer freshness, might have been stuck stabilized for 2.5 months. Bananas, avocados, tomatoes, and limes land somewhere in between. There are exceptions. Even in perfect conditions, most leafy greens deteriorate in just under 3 weeks. But even that would have been thought as a miracle when earlier grocers had 3 to 4 days to get them from field to fridge. My beloved blueberries have probably sat around for 45 days on their journey up from Chile or down from Maine. The core of this control comes from regulating ethylene, a gaseous plant hormone that causes ripening and color development. Within the right conditions, suppressing ethylene keeps fruit in a suspended state of development. And if the right conditions can't be created, the product can be sprayed or waxed with ethylene antagonists, coating them during production with chemicals that bind to the fruit's natural receptors. These modified atmospherics are complemented with an array of antibacterials and preservatives, perhaps a rinse with molecular iodine or a dusting with bioflavonoids. Nothing is simple. The needs of a tropical papaya are radically different from a Bartlett pear. But ultimately, our nation's storage facilities can build for that, creating an eerie array of these chemo-cryogenic chambers, all evoking some madman's humidor, little pods keeping each type of immature produce in a dreamless stasis until the market leans over and kisses it awake. I watch a few more loads come in and get inspected. And then, everyone busy, I slip through a giant plastic curtain into the rest of the warehouse. This is the dry goods area. The pallets here are stacked high so they tower above and gridded out in narrow lanes. The air is still, the vista endless. In the distance, a jack stretches off its base, extending maybe 15 feet upward, some combination of the mechanical and prehistoric, megafauna foraging on the high leaves, before forking into a load, shrinking back down and zipping off with its catch. Watching it move, I realize I'm probably the first person in weeks to venture here on just two legs. This section of the warehouse is a deathless space, the precursor to the center aisle, a reservoir of food structurally unable to spoil. The boxes bound in thick layers of translucent, almost amniotic wrap, an industrial goof where all the souls of our cereal, cookies, and crackers wait to be delivered onto shelf. Seeing almost any product in bulk is debasing, and it's no different here. Walking around the warehouse, studying the towers of familiar brands, I'm reminded of being 8 years old in McDonald's, pumping ketchup into little paper cups for my fries, and curious, lifting the entire cover off the pump to peer down into the reservoir, coming face to face with a dark, plump slurry. Ketchup as molten, grainy mass, nothing like the cute dollops I'd been squeezing for my fries. Commodity is contempt all the way down. And wandering the Aldi distribution center, I realize just how much materialism depends on individuality, on our ability to inject meaning into things. The longer I spend with Lynn, the more context she provides on her life and decisions, the more important meaning becomes here too. I come to see her as dedicated to a dream. Lynn is vigilant on the road, her attention thousand-eyed and all-seeing behind the wheel. I see her save lives when totally unaware sedans try to beat her to a merge lane. Off the road, I see a remarkable persistence, what she calls her ability to take it, do her duty and withstand, a sense of obligation that also rhymes with an ability to shut down, swallow pride, and self-contain. In our time together, I watch as she gets pelted with petty aggravations, canceled loads, endless hours of unpaid labor, impossible deadlines, outright lies, and none of that, from the most unfair to the most aggravating, is greeted with anything more than a chin-tucked, head-down, plow-forth attitude. The truckers I travel with are angry, conspiratorial, overtly paranoid, unclean, but also undeniably sharp, often wise. They are quick studies, typically self-taught with that mix of insight and brash insecurity that marks the autodidact. The ability to hum down America's highways under the moon, to watch it rise into blackness and eventually disappear into dawn, is privileged stuff. These are men and women who have slipped the 9-to-5 grind, shook the ritual obligations and routines that deaden most of us. And they fill that time with a type of quiet, non-judgmental observation that would make most yoga instructors jealous. It is a lifestyle that pounds home the reality that liberty and freedom are deeply related to loneliness and isolation. The most satisfied truckers I meet are the ones who have explicitly recognized and chosen that trade-off, who understand that on some level what they're asked to do isn't economically rational, but is instead an act of devotion to a certain myth of the American road. For those few truckers, it's a beautiful thing. But there are far too many who didn't make this choice, who are not warned about it, and for whom the job ends up crushing them. In my time with Lynn, with all her words, I see her occupy all these spaces at different times. You know, she turns to me on our last day together, if I ever lost my CDL for anything, they'd have to put me in the ground. This job is misery, but it's the only thing in the world for me. At 9:30 a.m., now the morning after Aldi, we finally crash at a rest stop a few miles down the road. I feel soggy, puffed, and swollen, my mouth raw from the non-dairy creamer and beef jerky dinner the night before. It's hard to imagine the type of bacteria that would colonize such a palate, but whatever species of microbe, they feel fuzzy on my gums. We nap for 4 hours, me crawling onto the top bunk, Lynn flopped with the dogs on the bottom. For the first time all trip, the truck is turned off. Is this an accident? An oversight? I don't know. But when we wake at 1:30 p.m., both of us staggering around like drunks, the cab is heated into a death box, and I understand the AC all of a sudden. I plunge for the side door and gasp at the light. All around us, 200, 300 trucks are vibrating in their lanes. I almost run to the strip of grass on the side. Behind me, Lynn is coughing like an avalanche, phlegm tumbling over phlegm. It is a new cough, containing echoes of chunky soup, a wheeze, and someone weeping. The day has begun, and another 30 minutes, we'll both be buckled in, heading to a new shipper to pick up a load.